You know, there are now three generations of post-Stonewall Rebellion GLBTQ people living out in communities. We are posed at a unique historical threshold. The ground has been prepared, and the health of our communities really depends upon fostering intergenerational relationship and dialogue.
At the center of my life was the curiosity about gay people and how they functioned and where they went and what they did. So at the center of the play Falling Upward, this group of people were gay, following somewhere around the world, suddenly appear in the center of the play.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A U.S. appeals court throws doubt on DOMA, tribal elders offer advice for social change, and gallivanting gays galvanize Ray Bradbury's Land of Blarney. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 7th, 2009. The first judicial salvos have been fired against the U.S. Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, a bill passed 13 years ago by Congress and quietly signed into law by President Bill Clinton. It bans any federal recognition of same-gender unions, including marriages in states where they're legal, as well as domestic partnerships or civil unions. Judge Stephen Reinhardt of the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled this week that DOMA is unconstitutional, and that Tony Sears, who legally married Los Angeles federal public defender Brad Levinson last year, was entitled to the same spousal benefits given to heterosexual couples employed by that department. The court's chief judge, Alex Kozinski, also granted benefits last month to Amy Koenigis, the same-gender spouse of Ninth Circuit Court staff attorney Karen Golinski, but sidestepped constitutional issues in his ruling, saying it was based on the vagueness of a federal statute about whether benefits could be given to someone who wasn't a family member. The decisions apply only to the two couples because they were administrative dispute resolution cases rather than lawsuits. But according to some legal analysts, they suggest that DOMA won't pass constitutional muster if it reaches other federal courts. They also predict that the rulings will put pressure on the Obama administration to push for repeal of the act, something that's already on the new president's agenda.
The two couples, among some 18,000 couples who married in California last year during the few months it was legal for gays and lesbians, await the ruling of the state Supreme Court in a case challenging the constitutionality of Proposition 8. That November voter-approved ballot measure reversed the High Court's May marriage equality ruling and constitutionally defined marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Its defenders are also asking the court to nullify all existing same-gender marriages. The justices announced this week that they'll hear oral arguments in the case on March 5th. They will then have 90 days to issue a ruling. A total of more than $83 million was spent during the fight over Proposition 8, according to the latest campaign reports made public by the state this week, which far exceeded previously released figures. It was already declared the most expensive ballot measure on a social issue in U.S. history. The final tally showed that opponents of Proposition 8 raised $43.3 million in 2008. The measure's sponsors raised $39.9 million. The Mormon Church, whose support for the measure has raised the most ire among equality advocates, barely reported by the filing deadline an additional $189,000 in contributions to the Yes on 8 campaign. The church had previously denied any direct financial support for Proposition 8, beyond about $2,000 for bringing a church elder to California. It has never denied, however, that millions of pro-Prop 8 dollars came from individual Mormon donors. The state's Fair Political Practices Commission is investigating charges that the church has failed to fully report its organizational financial support for Prop 8. The biggest donor to the Yes campaign, according to the new figures, was the Knights of Columbus, the political arm of the Roman Catholic Church, which gave $1.275 million. The Colorado-based rabidly anti-gay right-wing evangelical group Focus on the Family reported $657,000 in contributions.
Meanwhile, bills to legalize same-gender marriage have been introduced in Vermont and Maine, and a legislative committee held hearings this week on a marriage equality bill in New Hampshire.
Similar measures are also expected to be considered this year in New Jersey and New York. The Hawaii House Judiciary Committee unanimously approved a civil unions bill this week that would grant same-gender couples all the rights of marriage except the name. 32 of Hawaii's 51 House members have announced support for the measure. Its fate in the Senate, however, is uncertain. But the newspaper The Oregonian reported this week that only about 20% of eligible same-gender couples have signed up for registered partnerships in that state, where they've been legal since January 2008. LGBT activists say that the law may not be enough for many couples, and that some are probably waiting for full marriage equality in the state. The Wyoming House rejected a bill this week that would have allowed voters to decide whether to amend the state constitution to deny legal recognition to same-gender marriages. It failed by a vote of 35 to 25 after frequently emotional debate. Wyoming law already limits marriage to one man and one woman. The Iowa Supreme Court is also expected to rule on a marriage equality lawsuit this year. The Delaware Supreme Court unanimously rejected a lawsuit this week by a lesbian seeking joint custody of her former partner's adopted daughter. The justices said that the woman had no standing to petition for custody in family court because she is not the child's legal parent. The High Court held that, under Delaware law, a person who is considered a de facto parent of a child does not have the same rights as a legal parent and thus is not entitled to custody. The justices noted that the issues in the case apply to all unmarried partners, but that it was up to lawmakers in the General Assembly to change the statutes. A New Jersey Superior Court judge has ruled that a woman in a same-gender Canadian marriage can file for divorce in the state. Only married Canadian residents can file for divorce there, but the country does recognize divorces approved elsewhere. One of the estranged partners wants to remarry in Canada, but can't do so without a divorce from her former spouse. It's unclear if the state will appeal the ruling. The Boston Herald reported this week that the lead plaintiff couple in the historic 2003 Massachusetts marriage equality ruling has filed for divorce. Hillary and Julie Goodridge will share custody of their now 12-year-old daughter, Annie. The couple wed in May 2004 after nearly 20 years together, and neither has responded to requests for comment. High-profile Boston divorce attorney Gerald Nissenbaum, who doesn't represent either woman and is also a Herald columnist, told the newspaper that, "Whenever there's a cause that keeps people together, once the cause is over, in my experience, there's a high rate of dissolution of the relationship. It's sad, but it's real," he said, adding, "And what a surprise, gay people are like everyone else." In New York, a Manhattan surrogate court judge ruled this week that the survivor of a legal same-gender marriage is entitled to his deceased partner's estate as its sole heir. The two men, who were together for almost 25 years, legally married in Canada in 2008. None of the deceased partner's blood relatives contested the inheritance. The ruling is consistent with other recent state court decisions that legal same-gender marriages contracted elsewhere must be recognized in New York. Governor David Patterson ordered all state agencies to do so last year. The Czech Republic's CTK news agency reported this week that a total of 712 same-gender couples, 510 male and 202 female, have entered into registered partnerships in the country since the law creating them took effect on July 1, 2006. Almost a third of the registrations took place in Prague. The Czech Republic divorce rate among heterosexual married couples has reached about 50% in the past few years, but only 2% of the same-gender registered partnerships have been dissolved since they first became available. The author of the registered partnership statistics called them a great success in comparison with the number of divorced marriages. In other news, leaders of the 80-million-member global Anglican Communion, meeting in the Egyptian coastal city of Alexandria, agreed this week to continue to disagree about the place of LGBT people in the church. The controversial consecration in 2003 of openly gay Bishop Gene Robinson of New Hampshire by the U.S. wing, the Episcopal Church, and the blessing of same-gender couples by some of its congregations, as well as by some Anglican churches in Canada, have brought the Global Christian Fellowship to the brink of schism. Statements released at the conclusion of this week's five-day meeting by the Anglican archbishops or primates urged their churches to maintain a 2004 moratorium on consecrating other openly gay bishops and blessing lesbian and gay couples, but also criticized conservative Anglican provinces, primarily in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, for welcoming the affiliation of four traditionalist U.S. dioceses and dozens of individual parishes who've defected from the Episcopal Church over its progressive stance on LGBT issues.
the Episcopal Church's top governing body, the General Convention, will formally address the contentious issues during its July meeting in Anaheim, California. The statements from Alexandria deplore the current state of the Anglican Communion, saying, "Positions and arguments are becoming more extreme, and that rivals are engaging in fear-mongering, deliberate distortion, and demonizing."
And finally, the first openly gay person to become a high court judge in Australia has been forced into retirement after 13 years on the bench. Michael Kirby was praised during a farewell ceremony this week by Australia's Attorney General Robert McClelland as someone who will hold a special place in the history of this court. Kirby, who paid tribute to his colleagues and his partner of more than 40 years, Johan van Vloten, was legally required to retire by March 2009 when he turned 70. He often took van Vloten to state functions and said in a 2007 interview that everybody's getting used to it. "Prejudices and dislike will, ultimately, only recede," Kirby said, "when gay people themselves break the spell of silence and stand up to be counted."
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 7th, 2009. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
A famous all-around author turns his gaze from the Red Planet to the Emerald Isle in a stage production with a queer twist later in the program. As a veteran of the avant-garde film movement of the 1970s, Steven Soderbergh is something of a gay pioneer in his own right. He's currently finishing a video called Standing on the Bones of Our Ancestors, exploring the role of the queer tribal elder. And as This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend discovered, Soderbergh is documenting more than history.
Steven Soderbergh, tell us about your current film.
A feature-length video in post-production exploring the altruistic or spiritual dimensions of what it means to be GLBTQ. June 27, 2009, it'll be 40 years since the Stonewall Rebellion in New York City. Prior to the Stonewall Rebellion, there was little open public expression of the lives of GLBTQ people. Since then, an unprecedented emergence of gay culture has transformed society and the global village forever. What my documentary looks at is three generations of out GLBTQ people. Of course, we know there are a bunch of little queer boys and girls running around, mm-hmm. may or may not realize it yet. But what happens to those people, you know, of my generation, there's 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond? How can we grow in more meaning and value to our communities rather than retire behind a gated community someplace, or if you're privileged enough to even do that, or mm-hmm. you know, in a single family occupancy dwelling, you know, downtown someplace? And what happens to those of us who are entering the province of old age? How can we contribute, you know, our experience, our strength, our hope, our wisdom? You know, we live in a culture of kind of age apartheid. I preface the documentary with a wonderful quotation by Joan Halifax, the anthropologist. She says, "The wisdom that we need to solve our problems lies encoded in the depths of our unconscious minds, but it must be evoked by elders who evoke our potential. Without realized models to evoke our archetypal depths, we are literally lost in the world. Throughout history, elders have served as beloved pathfinders, beckoning us to enter the province of old age in anticipation of growing strength and usefulness to society." I interview Dr. Donald Kilhefner, longtime, you know, warrior and gay activist, co-founder of the Radical Fairies with Harry Hay, founder of the first gay and lesbian community services center in history. I interview Christine Downing, a mythologist and psychologist, author of Myths and Mysteries of Same-Sex Love. Malcolm Boyd, for example, civil rights activist, mm-hmm. Episcopal priest, author of over 21 books, openly gay for his entire life. Tom Spanbauer, Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon, a pioneer queer novel. Clyde Hall, a Shoshone two-spirit elder and ceremonialist, talking about what's come to be known as the two-spirit tradition in traditional Native American cultures. And Yul Brown, who is sometimes, you know, considered the father of sociobiology, Harvard University professor, states in his book On Human Nature that gay and lesbian people carry the altruistic impulse in our species, that we carry something around the betterance and furtherance of other people that allows our species to keep evolving and move forward. You know, there are now three generations of post-Stonewall Rebellion GLBTQ people living out in communities. We are posed at a unique historical threshold. The ground has been prepared, and the health of our communities really depends upon fostering intergenerational relationship in dialogue. If we look at our ancestors, no matter what lineage we're descended from, elders were revered. Certainly in indigenous cultures, the elder is always revered as a culture carrier, the keeper of the traditions, the mysteries. And, Yul Brynn noted as how gay and lesbian people seem to be pushing the boundaries. And the roles that they seem to play, fell around the arts, of course, shamans, priests, theater, has all of its roots in ritual and magic, teachers, service industries. There's something innate that we carry,
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of spiritual dimension that I'm exploring in the documentary, the spiritual dimension of what it means to be GLBTQ.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically in those people who have aged and kind of evolved through the crucibles of individuation and suffering. I mean, you think mm-hmm. of, people like Harry Hay, for example, and the formation of the early Mattachine Society.
Mm-hmm.
That was not all so long ago, and those people, were risking their lives.
Right, exactly. And the Daughters of Bilitis.
The Daughters of Bilitis, right.
For lesbians, yeah.
I mean, we have a long ways to go. I mean, we're still scapegoated in some of those heterocentric myths and stereotypes. The last thing I want to see is people assimilate, because truthfully,
mm-hmm.
I think we have far more to offer the dominant culture than the dominant culture has to offer us. Oh, it was a common assertion that the only difference between, GLBTQ people and straight people is what they do in bed. Well, Harry Hay, would say, well, that's probably one of the few things that's similar about GLBTQ people and straight people is what they do in bed. He used to talk about a subject-subject consciousness rather than a subject-object consciousness. Many people objectify. I mean, you look what Western culture has done to the earth, for example.
Right.
Everything is, for the exploitation. And whereas people tend to objectify each other, oftentimes gay people are objectified as who they want to have sex with. The two-spirited people were often, mediators between the realms of the spirit and the realms of ordinary reality. Revered for their counseling capacity, they understood both men and women's psyche, so they made perfect counselors. They were defined by a different quality of spirit, not who they wanted to have sex with. That's what I'm trying to excavate in the documentary.
It's not only important that GLBT people see this, but that our allies and people who maybe are on the threshold of wanting to learn but are afraid.
Now I'm in post-production, hammering out grants, asking individuals, trying to raise funds for completion of my project. I'll probably do a couple of versions, one for broadcast and one, I aim for a limited theatrical distribution, and I certainly could see it as a tool for gender studies programs,
mm-hmm.
through the universities. Mm-hmm. Contrary to being an aberration or mere sexual preference, being queer is important, substantial, and has significant spiritual, evolutionary, and social purpose.
That was filmmaker Steven Solberg in conversation with Dixie Trykle and John Townsend. For more information about Standing on the Bones of Our Ancestors, exploring the role of the queer tribal elder, go to www.standingonthebones.com.
Hello, I'm Carol.
And I'm Maria.
And together we're Zrazy.
And we're crazy about This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each program. All you have to do to receive one or both of these messages is email tworadio@aol.com. And be assured that we don't share or sell your email address or anything about you, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com.
Ray Bradbury's many celebrated novels include The Martian Chronicles and Something Wicked This Way Comes. But This Way Out's Chris Wilson discovered that Something Delightful This Way Comes when she sat down with the iconic American writer to discuss the surprising gay twists in one of his early theatrical works.
Ray Bradbury is probably best known for his prolific career as a science fiction author, penning such classics as Fahrenheit 451 and The Illustrated Man. But in addition to being known for his novels and short stories, he's also highly regarded as a playwright. Recently, Mr. Bradbury graciously invited us into his Los Angeles home to talk about the recent revival of his 1954 play Falling Upward, which takes place in the contemporary Ireland of that earlier era.
Well, the summertime, it's coming, and the leaves are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain time blows around the blooming heather.
I arrived in Ireland knowing nothing about Ireland. It's 55 years ago now, and John Huston brought me there to write the screenplay of Moby Dick. It was quite an adventure. Yeah. And when I got home from Ireland, about 3 months, a voice spoke in my head, and a voice said, "Ray, darling." And I said to that voice, "Who is it?" And the voice said, "Why, it's Mick, your cab driver, that drove you from Dublin to Kilcock and back 80 or 90 times. Do you remember that, Ray?" I said, "Yes." And the voice said, "Would you mind putting it down?" So I began to write my Irish plays. I put them all together into Falling Upward, and it's my greatest Irish play so far.
In those days, the pub was the center of the community, and Bradbury wasted no time in immersing himself in the local culture.
I went to Heber Finn's pub in Kilcock quite a few times, and I used Heber Finn's name in this play, Falling Upward, and his pub is at the center of the play. I knew that pub very well, and I knew all the people that lived in that pub, and a lot of the names that appear in my play were the names of people that were in that pub 55 years ago.
And during the first act of Falling Upward, Heber Finn's is indeed a very traditional Irish pub, filled with the laughter, singing, and camaraderie that can only develop after years, if not generations.
I'm always thinking how to gain my last company. Though the night be darkest dungeons, not a star to be seen above.
But the second act brings a surprise. Visitors who at first appear to have nothing in common with the locals.
Well, I talked to an Irish priest in a pub one night, and we somehow brought up the subject of gay people, and I told the Irish priest, "Well, I'm very lucky. A gay man has been at the center of my life. Charles Laughton, one of the greatest actors ever on the screen, became my friend and got me to writing a screen stage adaptation of Fahrenheit 451. So for Charles Laughton, I began to write for the theater, as well as Bernard Shaw. But Charles Laughton never mentioned the fact that he was gay, but I knew it, and at the center of my life was a curiosity about gay people and how they functioned and where they went and what they did. So at the center of the play Falling Upward, this group of people were gay following somewhere around the world, suddenly appear in the center of the play. So that's one of the most delightful things, I think, about the play.
At first, the pub patrons react as though they're caught in an entirely different Bradbury story, confronted with aliens from another planet. However, as this comedic fable progresses, there's a subtle shift in perspective, and when the visitors ultimately leave, a little bit of summer is left behind. We asked Mr. Bradbury if he intended to make a statement with the story of Falling Upward.
Nothing in my life and writing is intentional. I do not write my stories. I do not write my plays. My characters write them. So there's no intent. I don't ask my characters, "Why are you telling me this?" I just listen to them. So the gay people came to me and told me what they wanted to say. I listened to them and I put it down. So I didn't write the play. The gay people wrote the play. Heber Finn told me exactly what he wanted to say about the world, about women, about priests, and I listened to him. So he wrote the play too. There's no message. I don't believe in messages. I wrote Fahrenheit 451 about not burning books. There's a message there. But I didn't think of the message. It came to me from the fire chief. So all my characters tell me what they want to hear. It's not what I want to hear. And the gay people told me, here we are, watch us dance. Watch us sing. Watch us walk. So I watched it. Very simple.
And they ended up in Falling Upward.
That's right.
The play opens in Los Angeles at the El Portal Theater on February 27, 2009, with plans for subsequent productions in other cities in both the United States and Ireland. Pat Harrington, best known for his role as Schneider in the U.S. TV series One Day at a Time, is the narrator Garrity, one of over 20 actors who make up the ensemble cast of Falling Upward. More information about the show is available at www.RayBradbury'sFallingUpward.com.
All I can say is gangway, here we come. It's going to be a great time. I'm going to be there every night for months, loving the play and loving the actors.
For This Way Out, this is Chris Wilson. Special thanks not only to my co-producer, Christopher David Trentum, and Ken O'Malley, whose music you've been hearing, but to Mr. Ray Bradbury, whose characters invite us all to Heber Finn's Pub, where laughter is abundant and visitors are welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Dixie Treichel and John Townsend contributed program material. Thanks also to Christopher David Trentum. Ken O'Malley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUCR Riverside, California, to TLC Yamba, New South Wales, WPRR Grand Rapids, Michigan, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.